From APM, this is the Dinner Party Download, your audio culture atlas. Subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. During this political season especially, it's time we have an etiquette lesson.
Yes, each week you send us your questions about how to behave, and here to solve all your problems this week is Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd. She is known for her wit, her merging of popular and political culture, and her equal opportunity skewering of politicians' personalities. She got her start in the late 70s as a sports columnist for the Washington Star and went on to become a reporter at the Times. Her long history covering and speaking with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have culminated in her new best-selling book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. It's a collection of her columns about the candidates, as well as musings about the Bush dynasty and more. And Maureen, it is an honor to have you.
Thanks, Rico.
That's a lot.
It is.
Thank you, Brandon.
So you write of this moment in history. We're going to start with a quote from your book. We are in one of those rare unharmonic convergences when reality is more absurd than satire. Now, you've covered 9 presidential elections, so you've seen a lot of absurd things go down. What was the moment in this one where you were shaking your head, like, I cannot believe this is happening?
Well, it reminds me of, you know, the Stefan skit on SNL when he reviews nightclubs.
Yeah, the club kid.
Yes. And, you know, I keep thinking, okay, this election has everything. It has Russian hackers, white supremacists, small hands, penis taunts, Kardashian-like Twitter feuds, dueling federal investigations, yeah. Pepe the Frog.
That's a lot of movies you could make out of this election
right.
Thus far.
We need Bill Hader back.
Yeah.
So if reality is this heightened and absurd, where does that leave you, a columnist who usually is the one kind of using caricature and satire to kind of give us insight into the political world?
It's very much like when Tom Wolfe wrote Bonfire of the Vanities, and the actual events in real life in New York were getting ahead of him, and he was trying to keep up. That's how I feel. I wrote a satire about what was going to happen when Donald Trump had his first meeting in Washington with Paul Ryan and the Republican Party. It's like some kind of production of Taming of the Shrew. They thought they were going to bring Donald Trump to Washington and tame him.
Yeah.
So I wrote about how Trump spent the whole meeting pouting and upset and whining. And so then I called Trump and I interviewed him about what had actually happened at the meeting for the next Sunday column. And it was so exactly like my satire that I had to start with the first sentence saying, this is not the satire. This is the actual interview with Donald Trump.
Sorry, it seems like the same column.
Yeah, because, you know, he's like a tune. He's like this Batman villain cartoon. So the press keeps trying to figure out how to get their hands around it.
Well, that's a good question, though. How do you see your job these days as opposed to the rest of the press?
Yeah, everyone's always mad at me. You know, most columnists come from the left or the right, like Paul Krugman and Frank Bruni and every Tom Friedman. They all have a warm place to go to. and I do not, because I'm
People suggest you go to a warm place, a very warm place.
Yeah,
tell you to go to hell, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't write an ideological column. It's more like Shakespearean kind of, you know, showing the drama about how power warps people or how they rise to the occasion. So I think of it more like a watchdog, and that means you're watching both sides. And in this one, it's particularly tense because a lot of people think, as Hillary said at a Hollywood fundraiser recently, that she's the only thing standing between us and the abyss. So people think that we should give her a free pass and just focus on Trump's sins. But I just think that when you want to be the most powerful person in the world, you know, you have to be held accountable.
I want to ask you we'll get to our etiquette questions in a moment, but a question about craft. This is a collection of your columns. You've also talked about stress in producing a column. Frank Rich once described it as you dodge a windmill. Like as soon as you duck once, another one's coming at you.
No, being a political columnist is like what the great political cartoonist Pat Oliphant once called stirring up the beast.
Standing up to power, yeah.
And, you know, it's just hard. It's a little bit like The Godfather. Like, you take one of theirs, they take one of yours. And I'm just temperamentally not suited to that. Some people really like that, mixing it up. But the first 6 months I had it,
The column.
You know, my hair was falling out. My skin was breaking out.
Oh, my God.
This one Friday night, I came home, and I stopped by Popeye's to get some chicken. And I got home, and I put Clearasil all over my face. And then I was eating a chicken leg, and I saw myself in the mirror.
Column is going to be the death of me.
Yeah, I said, this is not how William Sapphire spends his Friday nights. You know, I wasn't at some elegant dinner party.
Well, William Sapphire, the former venerable Sunday columnist.
Yeah. And so I went to my boss, and I said, I really don't think I'm suited for this. And he goes, okay, well, you can go back and be a Metro reporter. Right. Which I had been for so many years. And I just said, okay, I'll take another shot at it.
You're like, I'll try this out.
Yeah.
Why don't we add to your resume etiquette advice giver? Are you ready for these questions?
Yes, I'm ready.
All this is from Patrick in Pittsburgh. Patrick writes, should someone at a debate viewing party be quiet during the debate or cheer their candidate? It bugs me when State of the Union addresses become exercises in performative applauding, and I want to avoid that, but is that just wishful thinking?
That's a great question, and I actually have a lot of personal experience in this because I watch the Republican primary debates with my siblings, who are very conservative and who I call my little basket of deplorables. and my liberal friends would come over and colleagues. And, you know, it's sort of like if you have Jets and Patriots fans in the same room. You know, if you're all Jets fans, it's okay to yell and scream. But if you have Jets and Patriots, then maybe it's better to be quiet. But the fun of a debate is if you can say snide things all through it. But now you can just do it on your phone on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, so and be quiet in the room if it's a mixed crowd.
I see.
So there you go, Patrick in Pittsburgh.
Look at Twitter during the debates.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania, a battleground state, too. So it must be particularly tense up there.
Right, exactly.
All right, this next question comes from Julie in D.C., and it's about another thing in Washington that doesn't always work, the Metro. The question says, I have a broken leg and ride Metro to work. Even though I'm on crutches with a bright red cast, I don't always find a seat. The people who usually offer me a seat tend to be frail older women. And able-bodied people don't respond well to my direct request for a seat. Can you think of an effective way to ask, aside from taking someone out with my crutch?
I mean, you could stand in front of them and just guilt trip them. But I think I'm very sympathetic to this because I sprained my ankle and have been limping through my whole book tour.
Oh, no.
And I love the red cast, though. I think that's really great. But you should do what I do when, you know, especially if you're injured and just take an Uber.
Well, that's easy for somebody with a job at the New York Times. What about those
well,
of us?
Well, only if you're like limping because it's so painful, it's worth it.
The shell out for an Uber.
Yeah, I find in New York, more often than not, people will shame someone to giving up their
yes,
seat.
Yes, give
know?
That Hillary Clinton glare that she gave to Zach Galifianakis.
But what is going on in D.C. where, according to Julie in D.C., she's directly asking able-bodied people, could you please give me your seat? And they're like, no.
Yeah.
What kind of jerks?
Well, you know we're in selfie nation and we're so narcissistic.
It's self-obsessed.
And also because of ADD, you know? I mean, people may need more stimulation.
So maybe if Julie pokes the person while asking for the seat, maybe
well,
that
I think there could be a class analysis of this. If she has a bright red cast, clearly she has health care.
Right.
And there are other people sitting on the Metro, probably working double shifts, coming home.
There you go.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know what? This woman's pretty much taken care of. I need to rest because I only have 2 hours before I have to get my kids to school.
Yeah, and they're studying the law of the seat treaty or something.
Exactly.
You guys, you're very magnanimous, you guys. I appreciate that. All sides of the issue.
All right.
Here's something from Jack in Los Angeles. Jack writes, when someone tweets disparaging things about you, how do you gauge whether to engage?
Well, I would say don't engage unless it's Donald Trump. Because this happened to me last weekend. He tweeted that I was a wacky, crazy, neurotic dope. Which really hurt my feelings because I thought I was special to him and I thought he would give me a customized nickname like Elizabeth Warren has Pocahontas and Chuck Todd has Sleepy Eyes. And then it's the same stuff he says about every woman journalist is just like wacky, crazy, neurotic dope. So I didn't feel special anymore.
So did you tweet at him?
Yeah. So I tweeted some stuff. And so he got my book up like by 50 places on Amazon. So that guy can sell books.
Yeah,
all right.
Engage.
If he flames you, engage.